All right, good morning and welcome to a live burning platform on this Thursday, the 5th of December. Here's Pumi Mashiko, here's me, and we have a special... Yeah, indeed. We've got a special guest this morning, and we're going to be talking about something quite specific and particular, which I like every now and then. So a big welcome to everybody who is from the usual comments section and crew. We will be checking in on your comments and asking the appropriate questions where necessary. Is there a woke agenda in schools? And if so, how is it undermining education in South Africa? Why should you be worried, either as a parent or as someone who's just concerned for the education of our children? I mean, we've got lots to be concerned about if you look at the kind of performance that we've delivered and the sorts of results we've delivered over the years. But there seems to be a lot more going on than most people even are aware of. Do you know much about this, Pums? You've got a son in school.
So I'm very interested to hear the definition of the woke agenda. And I'll tell you why. Because I think it's one of those things that it's a word that's being thrown around by a lot of people. And everyone is afraid to ask what you mean. Mm-hmm. I met Richard at an event a couple of weeks ago and had an in-depth conversation with him about it. And so I'm very interested and excited for this morning's show.
So just, again, proving the point that you should speak to the organ grinder and not the monkey. It's the fact that Pumi met Richard, that he's on the show.
No, it's not.
Oh, yes. He met me months ago. And I'm so not in charge of anything that nothing happened for months. But you speak to Pumi once and look at this. You're on the show.
Listen,
he's also got this is your disclaimer for this morning, yeah. Is he does have exam hangover because Richard wrote an 8-hour exam yesterday, which is the second board exam, right, to get your second degree.
I'm a lawyer, but I ended up working as a tax consultant, as a tax specialist. And if you want to be a tax specialist, you need to know what you're doing in tax. And so I went down quite a long road to become a chartered accountant. And I wrote the second board exam yesterday, which was a 8-hour exam at Gallagher Estate. I arrived there at 8 o'clock and I left at 6 because it's crazy. I mean, thousands of people writing this exam.
You actually could not do more to win me over to your side than being someone who actively fights for our tax rands back from fucking SARS. I'm a big believer in tax avoidance where possible, because I think giving this government a single cent more than they deserve is making yourself accomplice to a crime. I also think that what you're doing for the schools is nothing short of heroic, Richard. That's where I first got to know you. And I follow you on Instagram, I think on X, and I see these updates. It feels to me almost some of the time like you're fighting a one-man battle against some very, very powerful odds. Mm-hmm. But let's just talk about this thing that Pumi brought up, because I think this is massively important. What is the woke agenda? What are the kinds of things being promoted at schools by either the governing bodies, the teachers, or the education department that worry you and should worry the rest of us?
Yeah. So look, I think people often say, how do you define woke? My understanding of woke is that it's effectively a blending of classical Marxism with identity politics. So, classical Marxism starts with a framework where it categorizes people as being either oppressed or oppressors. And you can go all the way back to Karl Marx, back to the Russian Revolution. Back in Russia, they divided it between the Tsarist regime, the evil Tsarist regime, and then the workers and the proletariat and poor people who then rose up and overthrew the regime and installed the Soviets, right? Dictatorship of the proletariat. And that was basic Marxist theory, and they then tried to export this stuff across the world. To a greater or lesser extent, they were successful, but largely unsuccessful. There are a couple of countries where they got their revolution to work. One was North Korea, the other one was Cuba. But in general, the European countries just never really never really went for this stuff. And then Marxism got a very bad reputation after the fall of Stalin in the 1950s. The unbelievable crimes of the Stalinist regime came out. And I think in the 1960s, a lot of Marxist intellectuals were a bit depressed because they were struggling to motivate the workers to rise up and start these communist revolutions. Countries like America, Australia have never really elected a single public representative who's a communist. I think Australia had one. America, you know, not really. I mean, it's Bernie Sanders, but never really got there. And then what happened is that they discovered that they could mobilize people a lot more easily if they stopped talking about class and started talking about identity. And there are different vectors that you can push this down. The one is race. The other is gender. The other is sexuality. And arguably, there's a fourth one, which is religion. And if you can classify people into being the oppressed or the oppressors on the grounds of identity, it's far easier to cause division and to cause mobilization. And there's a strange group of people who come out of America who seem to enjoy this sort of thing. And they've spent many years and they've made a lot of progress in this area. I think the most prominent person who took critical race theory out of the universities and exported it into a more popular domain into schools was a woman called Robin DiAngelo. She wrote a book called White Fragility, and then she wrote another book called Nice Racism, which is takes the principles of critical race theory and applies it in a school setting. And what's happened in South Africa is that critical race theory came into South Africa, into our universities. I saw it firsthand. I was at the University of Cape Town from 2007 to 2011. I studied jurisprudence in the law faculty, where there was certainly an emphasis on critical theory. And I spent some time in the humanities faculty and saw a bit of it there. And I remember thinking at the time, this is poison. And what eventually happened is where it really exploded into public consciousness was in 2015 with the Rhodes Must Fall movement, which then metastasized from being, well, it's what's the correct word? It evolved from Rhodes Must Fall into Fees Must Fall and then metastasized across our universities. And that's not to say that the fees issue isn't important. It is important. I think it's absolutely essential that deserving, academically promising students are given a fair shot at university. I support that. But there was another undercurrent to it, which was real racial mobilization and sometimes pure racial hatred in our universities that existed from about 2015 and unfortunately continues to this day. Probably not as bad as it was. And what I discovered after the death of George Floyd in June 2020 is that the stuff had now come down into the schools. And what had happened is that a number of fallist activists had started consulting firms where they help, they call themselves diversity and transformation consultants. And what they do is they come into schools, they tell the schools that they've got a massive racism problem. And they then start implementing programs aimed at transforming the schools. And in my opinion, do not transform them for the better. They actually really make the schools very toxic environments. So that's my quick introduction to the world of critical race theory in schools.
So it seems, it seems that according to you, there are two problems here. The first one is quite obvious for all to see, that there are people who are on the grift. There are people who have found a way to capitalize on let's just say guilty white people and people in education who are left-leaning, and to get them to enter into Marxist struggle sessions and be paid for it, effectively. That's one part of it, which is easy to spot and probably quite easy to solve, because you cut off the supply and you prevent schools from wasting their money on this nonsense, which achieves absolutely bugger all. But the other part of it is the idea of this stuff being foisted, and I use that word with a particular bent, foisted onto both children and institutions by people who have an ideological bent, and that this is not necessarily valuable from an education point of view. It's fine if you elect to study this stuff at university. You know, there's critical theory for pretty much anything at university now. Whether or not it equips you for the working world is an entirely different question. But this stuff is available to people who want to study it at the age where it's appropriate to learn this stuff. But basically, putting race front and center for very young children, which is what I think a lot of these people are trying to do, rubs many people up the wrong way. Is that a fair kind of breakdown of the two major areas that this could become a problem?
Yeah, look, I think you mentioned the financial motivation. I think that is part of the motivation. I think what really sort of upsets people is that a lot of teachers have been hounded out of these schools on charges of racism. By hounded out of the schools, I use that term carefully because some of them have been fired. Some of them have been talked into resigning, which is basically, I'm not sure, I'm not a labor law expert, I'm not sure what constructive dismissal is, but it's basically like, we're going to put you into a disciplinary. If we find you guilty, that'll be the end of your career. But if you leave quietly, maybe you can carry on your career somewhere else. So, and by doing so, the school is then able to say, well, we've dealt with our racism problem. Three teachers have departed. We apologize for the dreadful systemic racism that has plagued the school for so many decades. And we're going to become a better school by implementing these diversity workshops. That's basically the format that's happened. And a lot of these teachers have been devastated. I mean, the one teacher I know said to me that she hired a lawyer to help her. But she only had 7,000 rands, and the lawyer charged 2,000 rands an hour. And after three hours, she'd run out of money or something. And just completely legally undefended, unable, not legally trained, unable to deal with these racism allegations. And I was recently involved at Pretoria Girls, where I actually was going to represent the girls. And then we had this incredible lawyer who brought a team of people with him who agreed to act on a no-fee basis. But the point I'm trying to make is that these teachers have had their lives destroyed. And what hits a lot of them is that, you know, teaching is not well paid at the best of times, but, people are making money out of this, which really sort of hits them quite hard. But I don't think the primary...
Are there actual instances of racism? Because we know that this is something which is a very prickly subject in South Africa. So if there are actual incidents of overt racism, we should be concerned. And in that case, it would give a lot of fuel to the fire being lit by those people who say that this is a problem. So let's be perfectly objective here. In all of the work that you've been doing and the research that you've been conducting on various institutions in this country, have you found racism?
I did this week. Came across a parent, I won't name the school, but guy who seemed to think that I would be interested in helping him, and I'm absolutely not interested in helping him. And my advice to the school is there's a separate issue there relating to fees. Is
that what's the incident so that we can understand?
There's a parent who hasn't paid his fees at a school for a number of years, and there's just no reason why a white guy hasn't paid his fees. And I understand. And I think I can comment on this because it was a media report.
Right, no names mentioned. But go ahead.
No names mentioned. But he went to court, and the judge said, "Why don't you go to it?" to a less expensive school, and that's what I told him to do. And he's unhappy because he feels that the bursary policies don't favor white children in the school. And I sort of said to him, yeah, but, you know, I mean, like, if you're going to an expensive school, you can't really expect that everyone's going to be given a bursary. And then apparently the judge said to him, why don't you go to a less expensive school? And he said, no, because we'd be culturally uncomfortable in that environment because they're not enough there are too many black people in that school, which I was horrified by that remark that came out in the court, apparently. And I'm absolutely clear to that guy and that I'm not here to assist him in any shape or form. So, Gareth, racism is completely abhorrent. It is completely unacceptable, intolerable. I think the key thing we got to do is we need to define racism correctly. How do you define racism? I define it as being bullying or discrimination on the basis of race. And if there is bullying or discrimination on the basis of race, there needs to be swift, decisive action against it. And I'm not here in any shape or form to defend people who are guilty of racism. I have come across those incidents very, very rarely. I mean, I've been doing this now since started publishing May 2023. I've published for 18 months. And I've assisted probably 200 parents and teachers now across the country. And I just, of those 200, I just can't think of anywhere I think, right, that was a real form of racism. What's happened is that they've changed the definition of racism.
Richard, before you start with that, I have a question around why it is possible for such things to take root in the environment, right? So
what things?
In what you are calling as a woke agenda that's being foisted on schools and people, and consultants come in with the motivation of making money and cry racism, and so all of these things, there must be an environment which allows for this new way of thinking, as it were. So if an external person comes into your school and tells the people at that school that you have a racism problem in this school, there must be something happening in the school, whether it's with the management, with the kids, with whoever, that allows this to take root.
Yeah.
And in the time that you have been doing this work and this research, what is it in the environment of those schools that allows external people to come in and tell people living a particular experience that the experience they're living is wrong and it's not what they should
be? Well, I think part of it's the internet. I think part of it's popular culture. And again, it comes back to how critical race theory got out of the universities and got into broader society. What these guys did is they redefined racism from being bullying and discrimination on the basis of race to being racism according to the principles of critical race theory. And what that is, for example, microaggressions. That is one of the main tactics that is used. So they say, well, racism encompasses microaggressions. Okay, what is a microaggression? Well, a microaggression would be getting someone's name wrong. I think I already committed a microaggression this morning because I was dealing with one of your colleagues here who said he'd meet me here this morning as I arrived here this morning. And then there was a guy who seemed to recognize me and say, "Hey, Richard, how are you doing?" I said, "Oh, hi, Sia." And that's actually not Sia, that's Sepple. Okay, cool. I've never met anyone. So I guess it's not a microaggression because you can be forgiven for that because you don't have a clue what's going on, who you're meeting. But if I were to, spell Sepple's name T-S-H-E-P-O, but it's actually T-S-E-P-H-O, that would be a microaggression. Pumi earlier, actually, I mean, before this conversation, I speak a little bit of Zulu and we're chatting to each other. And Zulu, I said, "So where are you from? And she said her parents or family were from KZN, but she's originally from Johannesburg. That could be perceived as being a microaggression because you're asking someone where they're from. It implies they're not from here, they're an outsider. There are an endless stream of microaggressions that you can commit. Another thing you can do is you can commit cultural appropriation. So there was a situation at a number of schools where on Heritage Day, if you turn up as a white person wearing any form of clothing or accessories that are not part of your culture, you are effectively appropriating the culture of another person. That's cultural appropriation. So there was a girl in Utah in America, went to her matric dance wearing a beautiful Chinese dress because, that's what she wanted to wear, and she had a nice dress from a Chinese culture, and this ended up on social media where some guy said, my culture is not your prom dress, and it got like 200,000 retweets or whatever. And so what's happening is that people are interpreting perfectly normal human interactions as being racism, and the kids are being trained to believe that is an authentic form of racism, and then social media is being used to amplify these allegations, and it causes enormous reputational damage to a school. The school panics, and there's protesting, and ENCA is there, and there's a massive racism scandal at St. John's College, or at St. Mary's Waverley, or at Rodin, or at St. Stillian's, or at St. Mary's DSG in Pretoria, or Cornell Hill College, or Herschel Girls' School, or St. Cyprian's, or Fishhook, and then the consultants come in to fix the problem. But when you actually look at what the problem is, it's not what people think it is.
So what I am trying to understand in your experience is, and I hear the example of Utah and what happened over there, is how these things get translated into our environment here in our schools.
Yeah.
And where the conflation of the two happen to be, because again, I think that things, like fees must fall, and how it then trickles into a racist incident at DSG is a stretch that a lot of people we haven't walked down this path, and I need to understand what that looks like, how the one correlates with the other, and at which point these outsiders have an access into a school environment where they get to dictate to parents, teachers, and children.
Yeah. So what's happening is it's the older siblings, right? So the older siblings go to university at Rhodes or Stellenbosch or UCT. And whilst at university, they get indoctrinated, frankly, into critical race theory. They were exposed to the Fallist movements, and they've got younger siblings in the schools. And that is often how it comes down. Another way it happens is that often I find many of the allegations of racism are made by a relatively small group of people who in some shape or form have connections to the diversity and transformation consulting industry. It's extraordinary how often, you know, former students will make allegations of racism against their school, and they just happen to, you know, work for their mother's diversity and transformation consulting firm, or run their own diversity and transformation consulting firm. And it's a relatively small group of people who can cause enormous publicity. And they can leverage social media, and what they've got are people on the inside of traditional media who are very sympathetic to their cause, be it in newspapers. I mean, we saw this at Pretoria Girls. It was unbelievable how the TV press and the print press went with Panyaza Lusufi's narrative, well, not Panyaza Lusufi, the Gauteng provincial government's narrative at Pretoria Girls, in a completely uncritical fashion, didn't scrutinize the allegations, didn't look at the WhatsApp conversation that allegedly contained racist communication. It didn't. Not even close. The one lawyer who came in to deal with Pretoria Girls took one look at the WhatsApp conversation and said, good grief, is that what this is about? I mean, she looked at it and she said, okay, so where's the bit that deals with race that's got like racist communication in it? And yet the press, you know, is part of this, because the press just amplifies the narrative and almost seems to enjoy causing as much grief as possible.
I mean, Mo Rabbit says here in the comments, what about the media? So there are two places where there's enormous demand for racism and not enough supply. First of all, in the media, because the media love any story with race, gets them clicks, gets them sales, gets them relevance, right? Because we know that our media in this country are scurrilous. Our traditional media are scurrilous. They will do whatever it takes to get stuff selling and to be on the top of the trending list. So this is why we have cameras at schools, where frankly I think they should be banned in the first place. News networks should only be there for very, very serious news events, because it's a distraction to kids. That's the first thing. So the media has this demand which they just cannot quench. And then we have an issue which is peculiar, I would say, to teenagers, but more especially to female teenagers, where girls just love a little bit of attention, where girls just love hopping on a trend, and where girls are especially socially malleable by other girls. And if something catches on, no, this is true. It's way more true for girls than it is for boys. We see instances of bullying online, which are far more prevalent among female teenagers than they are among male teenagers. It catches on like wildfire. Girls hop onto each other, and there's a tremendous amount of social contagion which occurs with young women. These are two areas where we have warm tinderbox environments which just need to be lit from the outside.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what's happening. And I have to say that, you know, the lawyers also, I think, are implicated in this to a certain extent, because they often validate a lot of the stuff.
They're also lawyers in this country, are also on the grift. I mean, we've got race grifters, we've got law grifters, and we've got people in the education system who are also left wingers who are looking for a little bit of shine. Plus, we've got kids who want to get out of writing exams. I mean, I remember I was at school. If we could cause an incident, if we could cause some trouble, and we did, we would, so that we wouldn't have to write a test or exam, or so we could get the headmaster into trouble, or so we could, I mean, we spray painted Pink Floyd on the wall of our headmaster's office. You know, we did what we could to get into trouble, and we were boys, so, you know.
But what does this then mean? What does this then mean in an environment like South Africa, where there are so many different types of people? And so many ways of rubbing up against each other. And I think that's the human condition, is we irritate each other at the best of times, right? So what does this then mean in this environment that is fast changing almost on a daily basis? How do you then perceive the opportunity of learning from each other, learning about each other, and learning to live within the discomfort that all of that causes?
Look, my view is that we have to move away from an identity-based way of classifying people. So I believe in colorblindness, which I think is quite controversial. I think 40 or 50 years ago, that was a pretty radical view to hold, and then it became normal in the 1980s, 1990s, and then now it's no longer seems to be very popular. But I think that what you're saying is that if we take this identity-based approach to things, we are going to constantly have division and strife in our society. We're not going to have a constructive, happy society, which is a great pity, because I think that the vast majority of South Africans actually get along really well. There's been interesting research produced by people like Franz Cronje that indicates that most South Africans are relatively quite conservative, but also quite accepting, and most South Africans get along perfectly well.
Sorry, Richard, I want to interrupt you with one other thing, is that there are so many parents, particularly black parents in South Africa, who spend their hard-earned money on education. And there are parents who've been told, rightly or wrongly, that education is the key to their kids having financial, economic, and social freedom one day. And I believe that is largely a true belief which is held by them. And they will forego almost anything for themselves. They will sacrifice so much for their kids to have a good education, which is an extremely honorable thing for those parents to be doing. Only for the education system and for things like this to give their kid and the parent who's paying the worst return on investment they could possibly get, in that the kid gets indoctrinated and not educated, or worse, that the school gets so mired in all of this nonsense that the kid comes out with something which is worthless and the parent has spent their life sacrificing for this to happen. Well,
let me say two things in that regard. The first is, I have enormous sympathy with black parents who receive information in the media indicating that their child or children at a school are being subjected to racism. They are absolutely livid, their initial reaction. I mean, here you are, you grew up under the Group Areas Act, you know, you lived through apartheid, you've come out the other side of apartheid, you've worked incredibly hard at your job, you devote enormous amount of financial resources to sending your daughter to, say, St. Mary's Waverley, right, or St. Sithians or something like that. And now there's a big racism scandal, and you're told that black children, including your child, may be bullied or subjected to racism at the school. You are livid, is your initial reaction. It takes a few months for the legal report to come out, but the legal report at St. Sithians, right, there were 66 allegations of racism. I think 50 of them were made by anonymous sources. 16 of them actually had someone's name on them. And the school brought in Cheadle Thompson, which is a law firm, and investigated all the allegations. And they set up a facility where anyone who made an anonymous complaint can come forward and speak to the lawyers confidentially, so that they don't have to put their name to it publicly. You know, nobody came forward. Of the 16 allegations that were made, the law firm investigated them. Their conclusion was that there's no further action that needs to be taken in light of our assessment of their complaints. So the whole nobody got fired from St. Sithians. A number of people left because they were so traumatized by the whole incident. But if you go and read through the memorandum of complaints, many of the actual allegations are really difficult to even – they're so sort of woolly and so based on microaggressions. And four of the complaints were that teachers had mispronounced a child's name. And look, I think there does need to be some understanding that older white people never had the privilege of learning an African language at school. They do struggle with African names, and they do need to make more of an effort to be able to pronounce people's names correctly. But in addressing the memorandum to the school, they misspelt the name of the headmistress, or the rector. They spelt her name wrong, and they spelt the name wrong of the chairman of council. called as Celeste Gildari and Carl Nolte. They spelt their names wrong, and yet four of the allegations of racism is that people were getting their names wrong. So
they didn't learn the lesson either.
Well, let's just have a little bit of latitude, a little bit of forgiveness for people. This is the extent of the racism allegations at St. Cillian's, that people were getting people's names wrong. But, you know, then you have a situation at St. Mary's where I think two teachers were left the school. It's difficult to always say fired because sometimes they just didn't have their contract renewed or whatever. They were effectively fired. And there were another five teachers who had to apologize. And there was a 56-page report that came out on this, written by two lawyers who were brought into the school to investigate it. The whole thing is based on microaggressions. And in the report, they don't even tell us exactly what happened at St. Mary's Way. What were the microaggressions? I went and sat down with the headmistress, or the head of the school, Mrs. King, and I said, "Mrs. King, what were the allegations?" And she said, I didn't get a clear answer out of her. But what I can tell you is that the whole thing at St. Mary's revolves around microaggressions. And so my message to Black parents is, unless in exceptional circumstances, of which I haven't come across, the vast majority of the stuff is based on the principles of critical race theory. Your children are not being bullied.
Why is your message to the Black parents? Why is your message not to Mrs. King?
Well, my message is also to Mrs. King. I mean, my message to all of these heads and the people governing schools is, don't bring in diversity consultants who are going to indoctrinate the kids into critical race theory and motivate the kids to become radical activists. Don't do that.
In the place of that, what is the work that needs to be done to ensure that the comfort level of both the Black kids and the white kids is taken into consideration? Why is it that if a person feels that aggrieved by the fact that a person does not respect them enough to, after a year of being a teacher, being their teacher, to learn to say their name correctly?
Yeah.
Why is it that that person cannot complain about this?
Well, look, I mean, people must learn how to pronounce people's names correctly. I mean, that is important. But I feel what we need to do in the schools is move away from a grievance-based culture. Although having said that, if in a multicultural world such as the world, when you move outside of South Africa, your name is Nkabasile, and you move to China, or Polani or something, you might have a situation where people struggle to pronounce you. I mean, I have
but
a situation.
But when you move to China and you can't say Xin Li, they're going to have a problem.
Yeah, so everybody
or
must,
you
everybody
move
must
to Germany
make an effort.
And you can't say von Schuckmann, they're going to have a problem.
Everybody must make an effort, especially if you, one thing I do feel very strongly about, and something I personally feel strongly about is that multilingualism is incredibly important, right? And it is crazy that in South Africa that very few white people can speak African languages fluently. All right. Is that your phone? I come from an English family, and I try with Zulu, but I can't speak it fluently. And what I think these schools need to do is place a major emphasis so that by the time you're 12 years old, you can speak four South African languages. You speak English, you speak Zulu, Afrikaans, and Sotho in Gauteng. In the Western Cape, you won't speak Zulu. It'll be closer Afrikaans, English, right? Let's place a major emphasis on multilingualism, because multilingualism is something that is genuinely useful and will make such a difference in this country, especially outside of the metropolitan bubble, which is where these schools are based. You go to rural Eastern Cape, rural KZN, being able to speak an African language is essential. English is a foreign language in this place.
We're focusing in on one particular thing, is kind of the pronunciation of names. And I do think it's important. I do think, both the kids and the teachers have to come to some sort of understanding that your name is X, not Y. I think that's a reasonable thing.
It's the first point. It's the first point of contact that you actually have with diversity. And I think in a situation like South Africa, and again, I said earlier, we're so diverse. There's so many different types of South Africans, right? With Lebanese, Chinese, Asian, all of that. And there's so much of a melting pot of the various ways of being South African, that it's important that we are able to recognize each other and recognize the the diverseness of who we are, because that's actually the one thing that I think is South Africa's biggest strength on the world field, is that when we walk into the rest of the world, we have so much more of an understanding of who we are.
I agree. But where I think there's a problem, if we do a cost-benefit analysis of this, I think it does help you to learn about diverse cultures, to learn how to pronounce things properly. I think that's extremely important. What Pumi's saying is correct. But I don't like the fact that this involves authorities, that it involves suddenly the education department, that involves lawyers, that it involves race grifters, that it involves all of these people who have nothing to do with a kid learning to be better. And it should be something which is negotiated between consenting adults and or children who want to learn. You know, here's a thing, here's a culture you want to learn about. I mean, Pumi's corrected me when I've mispronounced something, and I don't get upset and have a tantrum and throw my toys out of the cot. I go, thanks, Pums, you taught me something, and we move on. Similarly, I think when there are names that neither of us can pronounce, we're both happy to learn, you know, when it comes to guests being on the show. And I think that curiosity to learn is a good thing. Where I have a problem is that the adults in this story are making it about things that are going to hang around these kids for the rest of their lives. I mean, these are serious allegations. We know on social media that the cost of being called racist or being a race hoaxer or whatever it is, look at Jussie Smollett. I mean, the guy will never work again because he pulled off the stupid race hoax. And similarly, people who have been accused, and rightly, of saying and doing racist things have lost their jobs. So we know that the cost is high. Why are we doing this to our children? Surely we should give them a little leeway to make mistakes.
No.
We've got a bit of feedback. Racism is a warrant. But it needs to be properly.
Sia's trying to figure out what's happening.
It was fine just a minute ago.
Okay.
Racism is abhorrent, and it needs to be dealt with swiftly and decisively, but it needs to be properly defined.
It needs to be properly defined.
And not according to the principles of
Crocker.
Guys, we can't hear you at all now.
Can you hear us now? I don't know what Sia is doing. Can you hear us now? Okay. So, and I think our school has done an incredible job in ensuring that all the children are having a South African experience.
Yes.
And in ensuring that the kind of young men that we put into the world are young men who are confident in whoever they are, whatever their identity is, and that can understand that what they bring to the world is their whole self and not less of who they are. So what I'm trying to understand is, what is it from your observation and the work that you've been doing that schools could be doing better? So what is there to learn from an experience of what happened at Pretoria Girls that allows for a school to move forward and create an environment that will ensure that the girls going into the world, coming out of that school, are girls who are confident, who are smart, who are critical thinkers, and who know how to bring their whole selves into the environment?
I think the situation is more positive than people realize. I think that, you know, when I went to St. Mary's Waverley, I was given a tour of the school, and you just see these girls, you know, 10 years old or whatever they are, just playing together happily, you know. If you go to a school like Sicilian's, it is the most magnificent school, and it's got wonderful facilities, and the kids are all doing very well together. Pretoria Girls, my understanding is the school's moved on. I mean, the politicians and the lawyers are fighting about things at the moment, but the school has moved on. The kids are happy. And I think what we actually need to do is less. I mean, I'm a big fan of multilingualism. I think it's ridiculous that I spent 13 years at a school in post-apartheid South Africa, and I can only speak one language properly. And I'm busy trying to fix that now in my 30s. But we need to emphasize multilingualism, but then we need to refrain from trying to push Marxist ideology onto kids, whether that be critical race theory or gender ideology, which is the evil twin of critical race theory. I think everybody should feel welcome and they should feel part of a school. Regardless of their sexuality or their race or anything, right. But we're not helping the situation by hyping this stuff. You know?
So Richard and Pumi, I don't think that this is a problem about multilingualism or cultural diversity, because I know that schools all over South Africa are doing their, I think probably their level best, and they're all, my little nephew who's 8 years old, and they had a prize giving, which my brother recorded and sent to me, but they were singing a song in Setswana, which I think is exactly right. We come from South Africa. We must be proud of South Africa, all its languages, its music, its culture. I don't think that there's anyone who's saying we shouldn't be sharing in culture here, but my problem is still, what happens when, and we remember this hair thing that happened at Pretoria Girls High School. It just seems like Pretoria Girls High School is a fertile ground. Yeah, it is. It's a hotbed. So what happened there? Because I remember there was a huge furore about how these black girls were treated differently because they couldn't have their hair a certain way, and it was racism, and then it ended up not being racism, and it was like, what is this shit? I mean, why don't you teachers, why don't you headmasters and headmistresses, and why don't you schoolgirls just get on with the business of learning and stop trying to get in the newspapers, all of you?
Pretoria Girls is like the Olympics. Every 4 years, they have a scandal. 2016, 2020, 2024. And 2024 was my first rodeo. I was aware vaguely of what happened in 2016, 2020, but not 2024. I can tell you, but I wasn't there, but I can tell you exactly what happened in 2024. 2024 was utter abuse of completely innocent girls. 12 girls in a WhatsApp group. The one girl was unhappy because she had had an argument with a friend in the playground, and she had said that she's tired of the race baiting that she's subjected to in the school, and she just feels the school would be a far happier place if we stop trying to radicalize every single petty incident. That is effectively the content of the conversation. And somehow this ended up got sent out of the WhatsApp group, put on Instagram, and then the Gauteng government gets involved. And what the Gauteng government did was absolutely despicable, right? This is not a question of, this is a question of a premeditated, aggressive attack on a group of completely innocent girls, a number of whom did not say a single thing in the WhatsApp group. They were a hockey practice, and there's a conversation going on in a WhatsApp group that they're a member of.
By the way, Richard, it's worth saying that the court actually said that the Gauteng Education Department had behaved disgracefully, right?
The court said that. I said that.
No, you said that.
Yeah, but look, I mean, what's disgraceful you're right. There was a disciplinary hearing. I was going to assist the girls, and then they were represented by a team of advocates, and they were found not guilty, quite rightly so. And then the Gauteng government started putting out all sorts of disinformation into the media. They said that the girls were found, they said that the disciplinary didn't concern racism. The disciplinary concerned violence and bullying. And so we have to set up a separate inquiry to deal with the race. The disciplinary involved racism entirely. They then said, they were found not guilty due to insufficient evidence. There's plenty of evidence. They downloaded the whole WhatsApp conversation, and there was a printout of the transcript.
Why do you think that this particular school, because you just said know that they're like the Olympics, why do you think that this particular school is so interesting to everybody, including the media, because they show up, right? So I mean, I think a lot of schools have lots of different problems, because that's what happens when you have so many kids in one environment. Why is this school?
Because it's perceived as being like a white school, and it isn't, all right? I mean, there was a time when it was 50-50 black and white. White children now make up 13% of the school population. It's an overwhelmingly black school, right? So the idea that 13%, these sort of 100-odd white girls are bullying 1,000 black girls is just fanciful, complete nonsense, right? but it's perceived as being a white school, and it's fun. I mean, that's the thing people need to understand. I mean, we spoke about the financial motivation. A lot of it's ideological, and some of it is political. And I think we need to ask serious questions about Panyazulu Sufi's political agenda. And
what do you think his political agenda is?
I think his political agenda is to break up the government of national unity. And I think the way he's doing that is to try and cause as much racial division in South Africa. And I think he finds that the schools are a perfect place to foment racial division. And the MEC of education, who's not Panyazulu Sufi, is Namatome Chilwane, you know, he came to a press conference at the school and where he announced the results of his inquiry. He had appointed a lawyer who did an inquiry, who then said that there were multiple instances of racism. He hasn't released that report, and we're now going to court to force the Gauteng government to release the report, which is absurd. But I think at the end of that press conference, the MEC of Education said this is just the beginning. You know, from here we're going to go to Hoër Skool Waterkloof, or maybe there's schools in Ekurhuleni, or maybe there's schools in Pretoria West. We won't stop until we've driven racism out of every single school in Gauteng. And I think a lot of this is because it's ideological. People support decolonization. They resent any form of British or Afrikaans cultural heritage in our education system. So Pretoria Girls has got these beautiful buildings dating back to the Boer War. They resent that. And they want to drive out the white principal, Mrs. Erasmus, and the deputy principal, and the estate manager, and the governing body chair, and other people, get rid of all of them, and replace them with
If you want to find it, you will. If you dig, you will find what you're looking for if you're trying to accuse someone of a thought crime, because you cannot get into their head. So it's an unfalsifiable claim. In other words,
it's unfalsifiable.
If I say that Richard is guilty of racism, there's nothing that he can do to prove that he isn't. It doesn't matter what transcript I provide, because I've alleged that his intent is evil. No, I mean, sure, in a court of law, they can find objectively that X, Y, or Z. But if I'm looking for it and I observe you closely enough day by day, I will find some tiny infraction that you cause, which is not perfectly constituted to be a representation of diversity. And I can say that you are a major, major problem. If you want to find it, you will. It's also this insidious threat that kind of hangs over everybody. So everyone is constantly on alert. And this is not, by the way, good for the kids or the schools or the parents. It's only good for the education department, who are trying to push a political agenda. I don't see anyone else who benefits.
Discipline collapses in the school. And when discipline collapses, standards drop. And then teacher authority collapses, and then your school unravels. But look, I mean, Gareth, you're right. It's an unfalsifiable claim. So the big revelation in this report, which we haven't seen because Mr. Mdlamba has not released his report, is apparently that white teachers don't greet black teachers at the school. Now, how do you disprove that unless you put body cameras on everybody? You know, it becomes impossible to exonerate.
But how do you know that's the big reveal if the report hasn't been released?
He had a press conference where he announced some of the allegations, and it's actually quite difficult to interpret it because he doesn't name people. He says teacher A, teacher B. One of the allegations is that the husband of the principal is involved in supervising the gardens. He's not employed by the school. He's not contracted by the school. He does volunteer in the school, and his volunteering work in the gardens has actually been approved by a resolution of the school governing body. Is that racism to be a volunteer in the gardens?
I want to talk a little bit about the school governing bodies, because we've got very little time left, and I'm very interested to know about the school governing bodies, which is made up of teachers, parents, you know, community members. How much of a role they play?
In
making sure that their schools work or run in a particular way that serves their community. Versus what you claim is the Department of Education or Panyazulu Sufi's intent on driving this issue to be the spearhead of breaking the government of national unity.
Yeah, look, I think there's a war against school governing bodies, and I think that we're very lucky to have many of the school governing bodies.
Say that again? There's a war.
Yeah. I think
being waged by whom?
Well, I think Bela is a large part of it. The Bela Act that's come through now, I think, is taking some power, but not all the power away from school governing bodies, and I think it's going to be catastrophic for schools. And I think that school governing bodies are going to have to be resolute in standing up to political interference. And I think that's a big trend that's going to come in the future. And I think that, you know, Pretoria Girls is a very well governed school. It's a magnificent school. And that, I think, is because of the quality of the school governing body. And I think they're very lucky to have the people they have on their school governing body. They're good. And a very multiracial group of people. I mean, Pretoria Girls is an absolute South African success story. There's nothing wrong with that school. Absolute South African success story. 80% black, 13% white. Wonderful teachers, wonderful principal, wonderful school governing body chair. And what they have just done there is try to take a sledgehammer to break it. And they've done it three times. And they were successful in the first two attempts. And they've come back to finish the job. And this time they encountered resistance from me, and they encountered resistance from a very impressive group of lawyers who acted on a no-fee basis. And they are facing an urgent court application that I think was meant to be heard yesterday or today. And we're going to see what's in that report. But that judging by what happened in that press conference, there are serious concerns about that report, because the allegations that he disclosed in the press conference were frankly embarrassing in many respects. And there are also questions about the independence of the lawyer. And we keep being told he's an independent external lawyer. Turns out he's on the panel of lawyers for the Gauteng Education Department. Was recently awarded a 500,000 rand contract extension in respect of some other contract from the Gauteng government. He's far from independent. You have to test every assertion. You have to scrutinize the reports. Don't just take legal reports at face value and demand transparency, demand accountability. I mean, there's a story, a guy called Keith Arlow at St. John's College, probably the most remarkable. I don't know if you remember Keith Arlow at St. John's College, Gareth.
I don't.
Geography teacher got fired. 2017.
I was never there, and I didn't pay attention to these things, because as soon as I got out of school, unlike you, I stopped paying attention to school stories. Maybe I should have paid more attention. I don't know.
2017. Keith Arlow gets accused of racism, and it's a long, complex story. I don't think we've got time for. But effectively, what happened? Panyaza Lusufi drives around to St. John's and lays down the law to St. John's and says, "This guy has to be fired. Otherwise, I'm going to take action against."
Because at the time, it was MEC.
It was education. MEC. Yeah. Keith Arlow, it was a sensational thing. Eusebius Mckayza was promoting it on 702. Former students like Cesar and Paul Walsh all, you know, calling for this guy to be fired. He eventually resigns. And the final thing is he gets sent to the South African Council of Educators, which is the regulatory body, to be debarred as a teacher. So he can never work in a school ever again, because he allegedly made a racist remark. And I think he was found guilty in a disciplinary hearing at the school. And so now he gets sent to SAES, the South African Council of Educators, to be debarred as a teacher. I've discovered that he was subsequently cleared at that hearing at SAES, because he was represented by a colleague of his, actually a black man who's a colleague at the school and who felt that these allegations were nonsense. And I'm busy digging into why he was cleared. Why was he cleared at SAES? I understand that there was evidence that was presented at that hearing that provided compelling evidence that this allegation was not credible. He subsequently cleared. So I've emailed the headmaster and the chairman of St. John's College, and I've asked him for an explanation, and I've sent them the certificate from SAES saying you are found not guilty of the charges against you, and here's your other certificate saying that you're perfectly competent and capable teacher, and we wish you well with the rest of your career. I want an explanation from St. John's College. I sent a Freedom of Information request to the South African Council of Education, and I said to them, please provide me with the file. And they came back to me and said, the computer crashed and we didn't make a backup, so we don't have the report.
You're telling me that
the file. I went to SAES. I went to their offices in Centurion, and I sat down. They brought out the hard copy brown file, and the woman looked at it and said, "Yeah, he's found not guilty." I said, "Can I have it?" And he said, "No, Freedom of Information request." Sent in my Freedom of Information request. They said the computer crashed. I said, "Okay, what about the brown file? They're not giving me the brown file. I want to know why that guy was found not guilty."
Richard, this is a lot of time and energy and mm-hmm. and expertise.
I do it for free.
That you throw. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. That the fees paid are not necessarily only cash, right? So it is also
to who?
to anybody, to this process, to this entire project of yours, because you spend time, you spend energy, you drive around.
Yeah.
It is your intellect that you've thrown into all of this. What is your motivation for being this involved?
Why am I so passionate about this?
All these various schools.
Because I didn't do anything during Rhodes Must Fall. I saw Rhodes Must Fall happen. And I didn't do anything because I was too scared to speak out. I worked at a law firm in Cape Town. I thought, oh, if you go tweet about it, they'll find out where you work and they'll get you fired. And then I eventually got to the point in my career where I'd actually done enough stuff that I thought, you know what, if they do come and cancel me, I don't care. and then I started tweeting about it, and I just had this avalanche of people coming to me saying, my daughter was suicidal. My husband, we fled the country, and he had a stroke and is now living in an NHS facility on completely bogus allegations of racism. I read the story about Professor Bongani Mayosi, who was a professor at the University of Cape Town, not white, black guy, who committed suicide because of the woke bullying. And I went to Max Price's book launch, and I asked him whether he had any regrets about that. Because I was a student at the University of Cape Town. I had wonderful lecturers there, and I've been in contact with many of them. They didn't commit suicide, but many of them have left the university and have told me about the abuse they were subjected to. And I just get so angry when I see these so-called activists being put on a pedestal and told that they are, you know, that they're doing wonderful heroic activism work, when what they're actually doing is spreading division, spreading disunity, destroying institutions, because there was nothing wrong with the University of Cape Town. There's nothing wrong with St. John's College. We can all make an effort to on multilingualism is something I strongly support, and there's no excuse for mispronouncing people's names. But the idea that there's systemic racism, that and that black children are being systematically abused by teachers is simply not borne out by the facts. And that's why, if you are going to make these allegations and you come with a legal report, I want to see the legal report and I want to scrutinize it, because I think that's the least that people deserve in these circumstances.
I applaud you for it. I think it's great. I think it's terrific that there's someone who's taking this up, who's taking it seriously, and who's not allowing these spineless fucking jellyfish who run education in this country and who run some of the schools and who are incapable of even sharing with you the decisions that have been made on paper, because they're afraid that it's going to reflect badly on them. I want those people's names. I want you to keep doing what you're doing. I want you to embarrass them, and I want you to hound them out of education. They're doing nobody a service, not themselves, not the children of this country, not the educational institutions, which they ought to be preserving and looking after. I mean, again, I'll say parents have sacrificed their lives to send kids to very, very expensive schools. I didn't go to any private school. And I'm not bitter about it, but let me tell you, if I were a parent now and I were paying for my kid to go to a private school, those fees are exorbitant. And then they get caught up in this shit rather than in learning. I would be furious. Black, white, I would be furious.
It's not just private schools. I mean, it's not some elite project trying to protect private schools or something. Fishhook High School is a very, you know, regular government school in Cape Town. They went through absolute hell recently over the
I thought there were only old people in Fishhook. How come there's even a school there?
They got a school, and then there's Pretoria Girls, which is 87% black, a government school, doesn't have exorbitant fees, offers a wonderful, affordable education. And they want to take out the principal, the acting principal, the deputy principal, the estate manager, the school governing body head, over a report that they refuse to publish. I mean, please, come on.
Do we know anything about the politics of our teachers in this country? I mean, when we talk about these schools, because we know in America, for example, the Democrats are almost 100% supported by teachers. And we know that in education, a lot of people are very, very left of center. What do we know about the teachers at these high schools? What do we know about their own politics?
Teachers are apolitical, and they don't know what the hell has hit them when they get hit by one of these woke scandals. And they panic and they freeze and they're terrified. And they bring in the consultants who make the situation worse. They hire some work lawyers who make the situation worse, and then they sort of get fired. The problem isn't the teachers. The problem is the consultants, the journalists, and the lawyers who work together in a self-referential syndicate to create work for each other. The consultants radicalize the kids. The kids make allegations against the teachers. The lawyers validate the allegations, and then the media just broadcasts it and amplifies the whole matter. And you've got a vicious circle, a vicious cycle that destroys these institutions.
In other words, we have perverse incentives, and we ought to be naming and shaming the lawyers, the consultants, and the other people who are making education complicated for our children.
Yeah, I've spoken to over 200 parents and teachers, and I think I've been writing about this now for 18 months. I need another year. I've written 21 essays. I can't produce the content quickly enough. That's my problem. I can produce one of these essays per month. If I try hard, maybe two. Pretoria Girls took the last 6 months of my time. So all this other stuff that I want to publish, I just have not published simply because Pretoria Girls, I do this on a part-time basis on my weekends, you know, on the evenings. And I've written 6 articles on Pretoria Girls. And unfortunately, that's all I've been able to do the last few months. So,
Pumz, you have the last word.
No, it sounds like a lot, and I still have so many more questions, but I think this is an ongoing conversation because, you know, they are parts of the conversation that need to be had. So how do the consultants who want to get rid of the principal and the governing body head and this, how do they get into the school and get paid and get to get a brief to do this work if that's what's happening, you know? But I also think that there are points of inflection where hard conversations need to be had with schools, with teachers, with parents, with kids. And how do you allow that to happen, you know, if you don't shed a light on some of the things that happen? I mean, you spoke a little bit about St. John's and Mayosi, and these are schools that have incredibly high standards for themselves, for their kids. These are schools where kids commit suicide because of the way that they've been treated with teachers. These are schools where years down the line, you get stories of horrific abuses and that were swept under the carpet, that were never spoken about, that were, you know, and all of these things have a space in which they must be interrogated. But how do you do that if what you want to do is also say, oh, it's an agenda that's being pushed by certain people? Mm-hmm. There are many parts of this conversation, and this is no less important than the future of our country, because these are our children, you know, that we're talking about. And I think it's a big conversation that has many, many parts to it. And it must be conversations that are continuously had. I mean, I applaud you for the work that you're doing and the passion that you clearly show for it. And I think it's definitely something that has a space, but it is a hard conversation that everybody needs to be a part of.
For sure.
I would say, if you can, homeschool your kids. I mean, like, if I'm not a parent, and I know that that's probably the hardest thing to say to someone, because who has the time? And parents already have so many challenges. But I don't trust the state to educate our kids properly. I've never trusted the state. I didn't trust them when I was at school to teach me, which is why I read everything I could that was not a set work. And I don't believe that state education in any country has delivered a smarter, more brilliant populace. Certainly not in the way that independent education and a curious mind can deliver. Nothing can beat that. And, you know, if you've got a talented kid, I don't care if you're black, white, yellow, green, if you're tall, short, rich, poor, if you've got a talented and brilliant and intelligent child, don't rely on school only. Give that kid whatever they need to be able to get their mind moving at full steam. Get them interested in robotics and science and mathematics and language and poetry and philosophy, and feed that brain of theirs with whatever you can outside of school as well as within, because there's so much you can give them that the school system, no matter how good or bad it might be, cannot do. And to let them get mired in just pointless circular arguments around, you know, social and political issues that, frankly, they've got lots of time for in their old age, standing around a braai with a beer in their hand, when they can talk to other stupid assholes about pedestrian things like politics. Let them get going with something really powerful at a young age. get their brains full of useful and relevant information. Keep this crap out as long as you can. All right. I did say Pumi would have the last word, and then I jumped in and gave the last word anyway. So, Richard, thank you very much for your hard work and for sharing it with us this morning. And as Podcast Party SA says here, don't miss next Thursday, a 2-hour end-of-year special starting 6 a.m. with some surprise guests and some favorites. We'll be in studio live, Pum, so you won't be in there on your own. And I'm looking forward to that and a whole lot more. Stick around. And I see Jean's asking here, when is the GCS show coming back? That'll be on Monday, so don't panic, Jean. I saw lots of questions about that too. All right, everybody, we'll see you here on the Burning Platform on the Podcast Party next Thursday, 6 a.m. Don't miss it. Early start, just before the holidays.